Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Claire Madeline Culkin. Today, we will be discussing The Compulsion to Create, Women Writers and Their Demon Lovers, published in 2013 by ORI Academic Press, with the prolific writer and thinker, Dr. Susan Cavalier Adler. Dr. Cavalier Adler is a clinical psychologist in private practice for over 40 years, who holds a PhD in clinical psychology from Adelphi University's Gordon Derner Institute, as well as the founder of the State Chartered Object Relations Institute for Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis, where she has served as executive director since 1991. She is an ABPP fellow and diplomat of the American Academy and Board of Psychoanalysis, and has been recognized by the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. Dr. Cavalier Adler has received 15 awards for her writing, including the Gradiva Award for her work Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change, a New Object Relations Review of Psychoanalysis, published by Routledge in 2003. The book we will be discussing today earned our guest an honorary doctorate of literature from Ignatius University for her contribution to the study of women writers. Dr. Cavalier Adler calls into question the myth that one must be crazy to be creative, and raises concern about its implication that therapeutic intervention is a deterrent to creative growth. I'm so grateful to be able to explore this topic in depth with Dr. Cavalier Adler. Let's now welcome her to the discussion. Welcome, Dr. Susan Cavalier Adler. Thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network. How are you doing?
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you. I'm doing fine, and I always love talking about my books and my work.
I am especially excited about this work, The Compulsion to Create, Women Writers and Their Demon Lovers. As I mentioned, I had the opportunity to read part of this while I was in London. And in the end of the book, there's a section that is included in the newer edition of the book on Virginia Woolf. And so this time more than ever, I felt, as I always do reading your work, a sort of deep kind of personal engagement in your writing. I feel it kind of working on an unconscious level, which I think is so appropriate to this particular work, which explores the relationship between unconscious object relations and the creative process. I just want to draw attention for listeners to the new image that's presented on the cover of the book. Do you want to describe that? I know that that's a very important image to you.
Oh, yes, yes. I love the new publication, which has such vivid illustrations, and the one on the cover, it has pictures in red on a dark background, red on black, of the demon lovers. Basically, the woman writing with her demon lover with horns right behind her. So unconsciously, or even consciously, as she writes about her demon lover there in her work, the muse always turning into this eroticized bad object demon lover that she gets highly attached to because of early developmental attachments, and how they get played out in her mind as she actually is in the creative process. And the book does focus on women writers, as does my book, The Creative Mystique, on all women writers and artists. But a lot of the things I say would actually apply to men, but not about the muse. The woman has a muse that turns demonic, whereas many male writers have this muse that keeps inspiring them. And so in that way, it's different. So I focused on women artists for a reason, because they hadn't been written about enough, and in this book, particularly on women writers. But also, there's a whole dynamic with the demon lover complex that, and the muse turning into a demon, that's there in women in a different way than men, although some of the issues developmentally are overlapping with men and women.
So my question to that point, to the distinction between the way that the muse functions in the psyche of a male as opposed to the psyche of a female, I think can be clarified when you get into some of the the contributions that you made, that you've made to theory, importantly, the developmental role that mourning plays. But before we get into that, I'm wondering if you could talk about your personal motivation to begin this work. I know that this is an important work to you. It was, correct me if I'm wrong, this was your first book, and you did receive an honorary PhD for your contribution to an analysis of a psychobiographical analysis of literature. So can you speak a little bit about what you entered into the book thinking about and how that might have changed over the course of you researching the work?
Okay, yes. I've published 5 books as well as over 70 articles, and this was the first book that was originally published by Routledge in 1993 and had also a demon lover on the cover but a different illustration. It's now been republished, actually republished twice, but the most recent one is with ORI Academic Press in 2013. So the book from 1993 is now 2013 with some additions, as you mentioned, like the Virginia Woolf section, which relates to a longer study of Virginia Woolf and the creative mystique, which came after it in 96 with Routledge, and has been also republished in 2014 by ORI Academic Press. So, yes, it was my first book, and it came out of my own passion and gratitude for the creative process, feeling the creative process was so important to me and helped me psychologically survive and develop so much. So I wanted to look at how women who use the creative process, and in this book particularly writers, were able to mourn and self-integrate and develop or not. How much could it be a healing process? And I ended up finding out that there were 2 developmental levels that affected this. And when I write about the compulsion to create, I'm writing about what I found, not anticipating this, but found as I studied women who had particularly powerful father male attachments, that they dominated their work. That was one way I chose the women in this book, and had this unique male muse figure that really hasn't been talked about very much. I discovered that there were so many of the women, and in this book, all the women except for Charlotte Bronte, who's at a higher level, were pre-edibly arrested, and they therefore couldn't mourn and integrate in their creative work. Instead, they tended to repeat primal early trauma around the second year of life, in the critical separation individuation phases, where character disorders form when the mother cannot sustain contact as the child becomes more autonomous and separate from her. And so instead of a separation from the mother, there's a trauma of abandonment and fears of self-annihilation, and the person has to defend with certain whole character disorder, and they repeat the trauma, and they tend to act it out in their life, but they also, when they're artists, they act it out in their work. And so Emily Bronte, in contrast to her sister Charlotte Bronte, and I'll get into the developmental issues a little later, but she had this trauma repeated over and over in her poetry and her novel. And the other authors that I refer to who have big studies of Emily Dickinson and Edith Sitwell, the British performance poet Edith Sitwell, plus Sylvia Plath and Anais Nin in this book. But the Emily Dickinson, Emily Bronte, and Edith Sitwell are the largest studies that show this compulsion to create, where the woman tries to live in their internal world with their creative process because their outer relationships are breaking down or don't develop well. But in writing the book, I must say, I also was counteracting and deconstructing 2 very common shibboleths or kind of mythic beliefs that have surrounded the world of creativity and artists and writers. And that is that there's this mistaken belief that you have to be crazy to be creative, and that if you get healed through treatment, through a psychotherapeutic treatment, that you're going to lose your creativity. Now, that certainly is not true in an object relations approach to psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. There's actually the development of all creative potentials. And moving from the compulsion to create where someone's repeating a trauma and living in their internal world to a freer flow of creative, free creative motivation, where there's also motivation to connect externally and go back and forth between the internal world connection for creative desire and self-expression and the external relationships for interpersonal intimacy and love. There should be a free flow back and forth. And I speak about that theory of psychic health in my other book on creative women artists, The Creative Mystique, From Red Shoes Frenzy to Love and Creativity. Because you see, the compulsion to create is one side of the breakdown of that free flow of organic connection from the self to others outside and from the internal world to others outside. That's one side. The other side would be a love addict who clings and doesn't have any sense of their creative resources and really can't love but clings to people. And that is also a sign of the pre-Oedipal arrest, with the lack of mother sustaining connection long enough through separation individuation to be internalized and provide an internal holding or containing environment, which also is necessary for someone to process loss and process mourning. Mm-hmm. So when there's primal abandonment, trauma, and loss without the capacity to mourn, the person ends up just repeating the trauma, which you see in the work of these women writers who've been developmentally arrested. But this can be healed through treatment when it can't be healed through a mourning process in the work. So what I discovered is that someone like Charlotte Bronte or Suzanne Farrell in The Creative Mystique, who are at the Oedipal level and who had had enough of the mother sustaining connection and good enough contact through separation individuation, they were able to actually mourn and mourn later Oedipal level losses and move on with their life and develop their creativity more in the world, whereas the others would have needed treatment in order to be able to get to a capacity to mourn, in order to deal with the addiction to this bad eroticized object that turns the muse into the demon lover, they would have had to open up psychic space for new, healthier internalizations with the therapist, and especially one attuned to object relations and development. So these women didn't get the treatment, so they repeat the trauma in their work over and over. Now, if they had gotten treatment, they may have had a whole new development in their creativity. So it certainly is not true that creativity is aborted by treatment. On the contrary, it can be enlarged and developed, maybe refined, and maybe become different. But it would be able to grow, and free creative motivation can develop. So I counteract in my descriptions of these women the idea that you have to be crazy to be creative, even though these women were brilliant women artists who were had severe pathological issues from this developmental arrest, but they would have been creative beings in any case, I believe, just like Charlotte Bronte was, who reached the higher level. But because they had that arrest, they wrote about with incredible intensity this craving for connection and constant disappointment and abandonment and betrayal in connection, which goes back to the original trauma with the mother, compounded by things with father and later others that re-traumatized. Mm-hmm. So this is all actually seen in their work, and in someone like Emily Dickinson or Emily Bronte, who had that early trauma, but they had more schizoid defenses. They withdrew from the world and tried to actually live in their creative process. So you see all this in their their work. When someone like others that I've written about here, well, here is Sylvia Plath, and in the other book, Anne Sexton and Diane Arbus, they were more borderline. They ended up suiciding. So, and Edith Sitwell, who was narcissistic in psychic structure, ended up at the end of her life, when she could no longer get this act of applause from the audience, she ended up declining, becoming alcoholic, and losing her creative capacities. So there are diminishing returns for the creative abilities when the person doesn't get treatment and has that pre-edible primal arrest. But for someone like Charlotte Bronte, they can actually heal themselves through the creative process, which is what I was looking originally at. I love the creative process, and I wanted to see how it could be psychologically healing. And I was not focusing on the aesthetic quality. All these women were brilliant artists.
Right.
And it, whatever their developmental level. But I was commenting on their psychological capacities and how, to what degree they could or could not use the creative process to mourn the earliest losses they had, and whether they could, through mourning, self-integrate and go through separation and individuation to become more and more an independent, healthy person with freer creative motivation and the capacity to love and have intimacy as well.
Right. What I noticed consistently throughout the book, and what I'm noticing in this conversation, is the way in which you're regarding you're giving attention not just to the object relations in the writer as subject based on their the biographical context of their life, but also regarding the work as a representation and manifestation of those object relations as well. And what I notice you saying here is that the commonality in a successful creative life, as well as in a successful lived experience with real relationships in the world, is the capacity to mourn. And I think I just like to highlight that idea a little bit, because you've done such great work in positioning mourning as a meaningful developmental process. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit to that idea? Can you situate your contribution to theory with developmental mourning and its relationship to creative reparation?
Yes. Developmental mourning is one of my theoretical contributions to psychoanalysis and object relations thinking. And it is an extension and further elaboration of a certain human capacity to mourn loss and open up through that a capacity to love and create. But I go back, and when I say also it is an extension of earlier theory, in Freud in 1970 had mourning and melancholia, so he did look at mourning as a human capacity, but he didn't see how, he was seeing how it got blocked in the melancholic and versus somebody who could mourn. He did not yet see how mourning was a critical and developmental and clinical process. This came about with Melanie Klein, who wrote her paper in 1940. It was published on mourning and its relation to manic depressive states, where she actually used herself as Mrs. A in the mourning of her son and showed the actual subjective experience of mourning. And that was the first statement that mourning is a critical developmental and clinical process. And she also did something in that paper going beyond Freud. And I must say, giving Freud credit, she may not have ever written her paper. Freud didn't write his, so we all build on our predecessors. She wrote Mourning in Manic Depressive States, believing she was a Freudian at the time. And she extended whole clinical range of looking at mourning, but she also showed in that paper how aggression could be, is part of the mourning process or can be when it is brought to a symbolic level. She herself, as Mrs. A, was able to have symbolic level fantasies of aggression and destruction or competition with the lost loved one. And she was able, because she could have dream images and fantasies in symbolic form, she had an internal container to express the aggression and then move on to surrendering to the grief affects that we think of as the essence of mourning. When you feel grief about a specific loss and you feel that whole range of sadness, from pain sadness to ultimately love sadness, which is milder and healing and opens up love and creativity through the mourning process. So she was a living example for herself of this. And my theory of developmental mourning builds on that incline, but really integrates so much of British and American object relations theory in terms of how mourning is a is an overall healing process. And in my another book of mine, Mourning, Spirituality and Psychic Change, A New Object Relations View of Psychoanalysis, which came out with Routledge in 2003. It also got the Gradiva Award from Knapp in 2004. But there I had in-depth cases of patients in treatment with mourning, and then also in The Anatomy of Regret, which is a Carnac book in 2013. And in the Mourning, Spirituality, and Psychic Change, the first half is theory, and I talk about how mourning is explicit and implicit in all the theories from Freud through the British theorists. So then I integrate so many of the main, Melanie Klein, of course, Winnicott, of course, Fairburn, Michael Ballant, many theories, including James Masterson, who talks about abandonment depression mourning and character disorders with pre-edipal arrest in the American scene. I integrate those in as I spell out how my patients mourn. I show all these concepts being part of developmental mourning. And in both the compulsion to create here that we're speaking about today and in Mourning, Spirituality, and Psychic Change, there are specific chapters on developmental mourning explaining it theoretically, and then you can see it in the through the voice of the patient in the cases that I have in-depth studies of.
Mm-hmm. Just to relate this back to the creative process, which is so integral to this book, The Compulsion to Create, I just want to highlight something that you state in your own words in this book addressing the thesis. You write, "The extent to which the use of the creative process is reparative along the lines of self-differentiation and self-integration, as seen within the context of Melanie Klein's two major self states, the paranoid schizoid position and the depressive position." So correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a move towards the depressive position that allows for the mourning?
Yes, absolutely. The aggression is more, it's more enacted in the paranoid schizoid position. In the depressive position, it's contained and symbolized, and one also reaches capacity for guilt and grief affects and loss. So it's existential grief, not the more defensive, spurious guilt that Ronald Fairburn describes in other, but it's actual existential grief where there's a profound sense of loss and regret. That's why I had a whole book on Anatomy of Regret. But it is the depressive position of Klein is also part and parcel of all my thinking, and it's where you can process what's inside of you. You're not just throwing it out, or Fairburn talked about exercising it. Klein talks about the paranoid schizoid, where you experience everything as persecutory from without, but or you externalize always what's in the inner world, whereas in the depressive position, you contain what's in the inner world, and you can tolerate the affects enough to focus inward on yourself, and of course, in there is yourself in relation to early others and new internalizations with others. But it's a capacity to have self-reflection, and all the ego functionings actually develop through adequate separation individuation. And when that hasn't been adequate, you have to have a mourning process of that primal loss to get to the organic development of ego functions, which includes self-reflection and object constancy and interiority, where you're aware of your having an inside and interior world and feelings and thoughts being feelings and thoughts, not just enacted visceral things in your body and mind. So there's a whole range of ego development that comes with mourning. And you can actually see it happening when somebody's mourning in their writing as a creative artist. And in the work of Charlotte Bronte, who's at the higher level, you actually see her mourning process in her narrator, in her last and most eloquent psychological book, Villette, which came after the more popular Jane Eyre. You have character development, character-driven plot, rather than the plot-driven. It's more character-driven in its evolution. That's because the characters can actually grow. As she, the author, mourns, and she was mourning her siblings, going back to an early loss of her mother, and she was, her character was mourning. So you have specific descriptions of that in her narrator, Lucy Snow, who's actually self-reflective, very different than Emily Bronte in Wuthering Heights, where there's just reactivity in the in her ego, alter ego character, Catherine, who's like a devalued feminine, with the male Heathcliff being another part of her. And they're just enacting this masculine feminine side of her without an integrated whole woman. And I think you can see there the lack of ego development, whereas in Charlotte Bronte, you see it not only the ego development that allows self-reflection narrator, but you see it all of that developing as the character grows and the author mourns herself. So it is very critical that she was able to mourn in her creative process. She was able to mourn higher level loss at the Oedipal level, Oedipal disillusionment, the father, because she had a good enough mother inside. She didn't have to mourn the primal loss that much, although there is some of that, but it's at a symbolic level. It's not just acted out. It's actually mourned.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I'm wondering if you could, in defining the demon lover complex, which I think the compulsion to create kind of comes out of, and which I believe Emily Bronte of the Bronte sisters is an example of. I'm wondering if you could explain why is it that female writers provide such a special case and a window into the arrest that you see in the paranoid schizoid position, and then the movement towards the symbolic and the depressive position. What's so special about the case of the woman writer mm-hmm. with respect to that?
Okay, I do want to describe that, and I might mention that Martin Bergman, in his writing of Forward for the Creative Mystique, particularly said that one of the most original parts of these books is the male muse, the whole that hadn't been written about in this way before. But I also want to say the developmental distinction between Charlotte Bronte and Emily Bronte and where that came from.
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course, yeah.
Yeah, because even though I was referring to one being higher level than the other, I didn't say specifically why you see that in their development. And it's very interesting because they were both sisters. It's a great example of this developmental contrast because they were both had the same mother and father. Yet Charlotte Bronte was 5 years old when her mother died of cancer, and Emily Bronte was 2 when the mother got ill and just verging on 3 when the mother died, which is the critical separation individuation period. So Charlotte Bronte was at the higher Oedipal level where she had already internalized enough of the mother who was sustained good enough contact through separation individuation. And her father then became the focus, as it does in the Oedipal stage for a female child. And the father then became the object of so much of her writing through other male characters in terms of resolving disillusionment and also with a somewhat narcissistic father figure. But she had enough to do the mourning in her work because the mother had been with her and got internalized and also developed through separation individuation the ego functions to allow it to reflect and feel and contain affects through the mourning process. Whereas her sister, Emily Bronte, disrupted by the mother's illness and death when she was in the critical separation individuation period, could not mourn in her work and was arrested in pathological mourning, which in object relations terms is a demon lover complex because the at least for the woman, she gets attached to the eroticized bad object. Now, this would be true for a man, too, who's disrupted. He could have that disruption, the eroticized attachment to an eroticized bad mother with a pre-Oedipal disruption in mothering and at a traumatic level. However, it's interesting in the creative work how this comes out in this theme of the male muse turning into the demon for women artists and writers. And Emily Bronte had it in her images of forces of nature, the night wind, the god muse figure coming towards her where she's yearning to merge with him and ends up being possessed, abandoned, and then ends up with her dying. And there's an image of a tombstone at the end of a poem. And her, the woman's voice, the creative poet, she loses her voice in the man, in the male part of her coming at her and taking over. So that male muse turning to the demon is very, very unique in the writing of women, because in the men, they tend to have female muses who stay with them.
Hmm.
And I've also done some of this writing in terms of women with women, like it can be so in lesbian relationships with the muse demon. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, just the distinct genders, but the main thing is the psychological dynamics of it that get played out from the developmental levels.
Right.
Does that answer the question you were asking, or do I need to?
No. I think it definitely does. I think it definitely does. Although I do still have a question about what it is that you mean when you say with male writers or creators, the female muse stays with them, whereas with the relationship between women writers and male muses, the male kind of becomes stuck in this kind of position of condemnation. Why is that? What is that? What do you mean by that when you say the female muse stays with the male?
It's just what I've seen in literary work. The whole demon lover is a literary theme that goes back to the 18th century, and Coleridge writes about the woman wailing for her demon lover. So from the start, it was the theme of the demon lover was related to women.
Mm-hmm.
The poet Coleridge in the Romantic tradition, and they wrote about the woman wailing for her demon lover in the middle of the night. But yeah, there are traditionally we think of muses as always inspiring, and that's really come from the male artists and writer literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I wrote about this, and this also was commented on by you know, Joyce McDougall, who did the foreword for this book, and also for Morning Spirituality and Psychic Change, along with Martin Bergman, were particularly struck by this thing about the woman having a male muse turn into a demonic figure in the demon lover complex. So you can have demon lover themes, and you can have demon lover complex. Charlotte Bronte had some chauvinistic male in the beginning of Villette, so he had a kind of demon lover theme, but then it was resolved, and the man and woman affected each other as whole objects who could interpenetrate psychically and actually learn to love each other. Very, very different than what happens with Emily Bronte, where the male and female parts of her that have become the devalued feminine side you see in Catherine in Wuthering Heights, and the manic erotic intensity of this overwhelming masculine force of Heathcliff, they kill each other off. The Heathcliff's manic erotic intensity causes Catherine to faint and die, get ill and die, and then he dies to go to her. It's like they kill each other off, whereas Charlotte Bronte's characters develop as whole objects, and they actually learn to love each other, and they actually go through character change in the novel, with the woman affecting the man. So the demon lover theme turns into a theme of love, whereas in the demon lover complex, with the compulsion to create and these other women with pre-Oedipal arrests like Emily Bronte, there is the male and female killing each other off, or the woman being killed off in her poetry by the god muse male. Emily Dickinson speaks of this male god figure as the metallic god who drills his welcome in, and all her terror of male sexuality is seen there. And she actually refused the one man who asked her to marry her, who she actually loved, she had was forced to say no to, and she ends up rationalizing it and saying no is the most exciting word in the English language. But actually she was then forced to live in this more and more secluded place. It's interesting that I also had an article on this Emily Dickinson, the subject of seclusion, that has been very widely read. But in the book here, you see that how she goes more into seclusion, and the poetry reflects it. And she gave up her chance to have a real relationship with a man in the external world. So that's when the inner muse becomes even more demonic, because of the isolation or the failing of external relationships with men in the more borderline characters, or the actual failure of any relationships with men, and receding into the internal world in the Emily Bronte or Emily Dickinson. Now, I'm not sure I fully answered your question about men, because my focus hadn't been on male creativity. I just know that the traditional theme with male muse is that the muse continues to inspire them. They don't have to submit to the woman.
Right.
Whereas in Emily Bronte, she actually, as the female voice and yearning, saying, and she says, visions of kill me with desire, the visions of the muse coming towards her, kill her with desire. She's waiting to merge with this mammoth male, masculinized and eroticized godlike force. And then when, as he approaches her, she is forced to submit. She talks about being imprisoned, then betrayed. And then you get to that, you know, the image of the end of a poem of the burial ground with the tombstone. So the female is killed by her submission to this omnipotent male force.
Yeah, there's something of the power dynamics that I guess is more clearly elaborated in this case, in the case of the women writers with the male muses. I want to just point to, being that you're mentioning this example of Emily Bronte, I just want to point to a few lines of text that I just thought were so poetic. Mm-hmm. You write, "To picture Emily Bronte is to picture a being turned inward, away from the world. She can be seen clinging to her internal objects of suffering, fixed in rigid pose, morning never comes, although the writer is frozen in the pose of mourner, and her poetry has frequent funeral episodes.
Yes, frozen in time, frozen in pathological mourning, needing to mourn, not being able to mourn. Ida Sitwell, who's the more narcissistic psychic structure, also character disorder, she reached the word mourning in one of her poems and stopped writing poetry for 10 years.
Wow.
Because she couldn't do the mourning. And she wrote some rather bad biographies at that point, but she didn't do any poetry, which was the essence of the way she expressed herself in the world for 10 years. And then when she did go back to poetry, she had to do it by being in a manic defense, where she was the more narcissistic, so she went into the manic defense rather than the schizoid defense that Emily Brontë and Emily Dickinson went into, or the borderline suicidal stuff of the borderline poets and writers. So she went into a manic defense where she became known as a wartime prophet poet in Britain. And she was the one above the victim-villain drama of the devalued feminine and the overly aggressive masculine. They were part objects. And again, they were in conflict, killing each other off. And she was above it, saying wise things at the prophet in the manic stance. But she could not go from within and express her inner self. She had to be in her head above the part object characters that had the victim-villain dramas of the demon-lover complex. Because she couldn't mourn, she couldn't own her insides, tolerate the affect states, and subjectively grow in her work. So, and in Emily Dickinson, I might just read a passage of a poem that shows that pathological mourning state where she is in a whole scene of mourning where she can't mourn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's explicit, this pathological mourning state in object relations terms of just being stuck there. She writes, and this is 245 in the new version of The Compulsion to Create. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell and being but an ear, and I in silence some strange race wrecked solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then. In other words, she was losing her mind, and she actually had a psychotic episode trying to use the poetry to describe it afterwards. And another poem, it was not death, for I stood up and all the dead lie down. It was not. It was a living death, and it was a pathological mourning state. And again, she writes another poem, I felt a cleaving in my mind, which goes to that primal split of the idealized and demonic primal object that you have in pre-Oedipal arrest, where you have primal pathological split that continues and creates that character disorder experience in life.
Yeah. I think it seems to make a lot of sense that this would be, that this kind of relationship to mourning, whether in arrested form or actually engaging in the mourning process, would be represented in the language at the level of the symbolic. That seems to make a lot of sense. And I think just as you observe that happening in the language itself, in the words that are used, in the symbols that are used, you also kind of are very uniquely attentive to the way that that's represented in kind of the narrative development and in the relationships between characters. I feel like that's most obvious in the case of Charlotte Bronte. I just want to point to a way that you describe Villette. You You write
a whole chapter on Villette, which is her last novel.
Yeah. Right. You write, Villette truly is more wonderful a book than Jane Eyre, with the sustained power and profundity lacking in the earlier novel. Villette possesses a reflective quality that makes it a more internally powerful work than Jane Eyre, the excitement of which derives largely from its boldly dramatic plot. In contrast, Villette seems to emerge out of vivid, visceral consciousness of its author. The writing conveys, and I love this line, an almost somatic sense of repression. Periodic eruptions of suppressed affect punctuate the novel's neurotically hesitant movement. That description seems to be kind of operating on the same level of this, of the passage that you just kind of pointed out from Emily Dickinson, except it represents the opposite. What does the language look like when mourning is happening?
Exactly. And I want to read one paragraph from Charlotte Bronte in Villette where she puts it in her words about the mourning, which she does have the capacity to do. Both the process and the content of the creativity is affected by development and developmental level and psychic structure in the internal world. And that, I think, is something that has not been seen or acknowledged. And so when my book came out in 93, there were controversial responses to that. Some people wanted to believe it just literature's whatever, some free imagination, and has nothing that has that would be defining it or limiting it or shaping it. Let's shaping it more than limiting it. But so both the content and the process are affected by developmental level, but then, of course, within that is the brilliance and originality and imagination of the person.
Right.
And all these women were brilliant women artists. So I'll just read a little bit from Charlotte herself in Villette, which was her last book after Jane Eyre. She had four novels. And this is her speaking in Villette as Lucy Snow, her self-reflective character. And I introduce it by saying, despite this premature burial of feeling, which she has in another paragraph in its object, where she buries a letter of a man that she has unrequited love with, Graham, in the novel, Lucy Charlotte has felt the keen cut of her loss enough for conscious grief to yield to love. This is me. Despite her self-expression and her indirectly aggressive assault on the man contained within her internal burial ground, her suffering is experienced. Love emerges within the context of mournful suffering. And then this is she, Charlotte. Alas, something came rushing into my eyes, dimming utterly their vision, blotting from sight the schoolroom, the garden, the bright winter sun, as I remembered that never more would letters such as he had read come to me. I had seen the last of them. He wrote the letters and then read it to her. That goodly river on whose banks had sojourned, of whose waves a few reviving drops had trickled to my lips, was bending to another course. It was leaving my little hut and field forlorn and sand dry, pouring its wealth of waters far away. The change was right, just natural. Not a word could be said, but I loved my Rhine, my Nile. I had almost worshipped my Ganges and grieved that the grand tide should roll estranged, should vanish like a false mirage. Though stoical, I was not quite a stoic. Drops streamed fast on my hands, on my disc. I wept one sultry shower, heavy and brief. So there's the conscious despair, and Lucy creates meaning in her life, I say then, even in the absence of bonding and support from her environment, because the guy has left her, and she's bereft, but she has enough inside to mourn and find meaning in who he was to her. That's a big part of what mourning is, actually finding the meaning of what the relationship was with that person and who that person was to you. So she does all that cognitive work along with the affect emotional work and showing her integrated psychological status in that way.
Right. So with these other women writers who represent the compulsion to create, which you understand is emerging out of a pre-Oedipal level of developmental arrest, if you're considering that it's in language or it's at the level of the symbolic that we're working out our unconscious conflicts and our object relations, then there's necessarily going to be a relationship between the creative process and the therapeutic process in that both intervene on the same level. Is that an accurate summation of one of your main points in, or one of the things that you came to discover throughout researching the compulsion to create?
Are you saying there's an analogy between the therapeutic process and creative process at the developmental level? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it just naturally would happen that the woman would be writing from that place. And then in therapy, of course, one goes to whatever point where the person is located internally. Mm-hmm. And it's in a whole other realm of creativity and therapeutic work when the person is blocked rather than being in the compulsion to create with developmental arrest. There are neurotic level people who do reach that Oedipal stage who have blocking because they have neurotic defenses of repression. The person with the compulsion to create has what Melanie Klein calls the defenses of the paranoid schizoid position, mm-hmm. primal splitting, projective identification, things projected out and enacted externally or enacted internally, but outside of the subjective self. And then there's this primal split and further dissociative splitting. Those are the kind of defensive process. Whereas in someone at a neurotic level, they can become locked in their creativity and suffer a great deal and need treatment to help them with it, but they're actually suffering from repression with repressed memories, repressed early trauma, but mm-hmm. still having gotten to a symbolic level and a level where containing repression can allow them to participate and lie on the couch and be in a psychoanalytic process. And I have someone who comes four times a week specifically for work with a writing block because this is what she wanted to do more than anything in her life. Beyond the career she developed, beyond relationships she developed, beyond her everything she has in the world, she wants so much to write mm-hmm. creative fiction, and so she's suffering when the blocking. Now she's opened up and done some beautiful stories, but the block comes back. So we work through many, many levels of it. But there we're dealing with repression and memories and early loss that comes up and all the aggression and rage from early childhood to open up someone who's a block so they can create. And that's in a neurotic level, whereas the compulsion to create is the pathology with character disorders at the pre-Oedipal level of where they're arrested and have this primal split because they didn't have enough from the mother to integrate all the parts of themselves and to integrate the image of the, at a symbolic image level, the mother.
So, and do you believe that a therapeutic intervention would be able to help those particular individuals, not just in their creative process, but as in their self-development?
Absolutely. They go together. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, one doesn't have to be a creative artist to get treatment for this. The compulsion to create is also what any character disorder would have in compulsive reenactment in their life or whatever work they do, you know, in their relationships and in their work of this primal trauma and going from seeing the others idealized to seeing them as demonic or devalued and themselves also going from being aggrandized to being, you know, totally worthless and feeling like fears of abandonment and annihilation all the time.
Yeah. I think that's a wonderful place to stop. I think this, the particular example that you gave of your clinical experience, just so beautifully drives home, you know, just your main interest in researching this, researching the subject, which is to see a meaningful and productive relationship between therapeutic work and the creative process. And I have to say, as somebody who's currently in an MFA program for creative writing, if you're a listener who is analytically minded but has a personal relationship with any of the women writers who are represented in this book, I can promise you that reading this will just deepen that relationship and impact you really strongly. So I encourage everybody to read it.
I just want to mention that I always have had writing groups in my practice and mm-hmm. currently have a group, but I also work individually with people, both with blocks and compulsions around creativity as well as in all of, you know, all other ways that people suffer in life.
That's great. And will listeners be able to see that information on your website if we link to it?
Yes, it's www.cavaleradler.com, K-A-V-A-L-E-R-A-D-L-E-R.com. Just my name without the hyphen, K-A-V-A-L-E-R-A-D-L-E-R.com. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Susan, it's been wonderful speaking with you again. And I thank you so much for coming on to the New Books Network.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, and I really enjoy articulating these ideas for people to benefit from. Thank you so much.